From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
Is there a law prohibiting free speech or blasphemy? Is there prohibitions against humanists or non-religious people from holding political office? Items like that.
This week, Humanist International released its annual Comprehensive Freedom of Thought Report 2021, full of important data about the legal and human rights situation for humanists, atheists, and the non-religious around the world. I'm looking forward to getting some highlights from American Humanist Association Policy and Social Justice Director, Rachel Deitch.
I'm Ray Kirstein from the intersection of religion, government, and raw power. The U.S. Catholic bishops gathered in Baltimore this week with an expressed interest in unity. But the American hierarchy is as fragmented, it appears, as is the rest of our society right now. Where the church might be serving the critical task of bringing people together around shared values, L.A. Archbishop Gomez doubled down on his vision of a historically Christian, dogmatically defined American culture. Others were loudly preparing to push for withholding sacraments from Catholic politicians they don't feel they have enough control over, to hell with repeated entreaties from Pope Francis himself to avoid such rhetoric. A number of court cases are being tried simultaneously, and progressive faith leaders are making sure they are on hand to represent faith values that are often overlooked in public coverage. Hundreds of black pastors continue to stand vigil at the trial of Ahmaud Arbery's accused killers, despite the defense incredibly claiming that their presence was intimidating to jurors. Meanwhile, hundreds were arrested in the nation's capital at a protest led by the Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign over voting rights and discrimination. And House Minority Leader McCarthy weighed in on this week's unprecedented violent imagery from House members Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, who were removed from their committee assignments by outraged colleagues by promising to reinstate the disgraced Republicans if the GOP regains the majority next fall. Maybe even better assignments, McCarthy clarified. Greene in particular has outraged many Americans with obnoxiously and consistently anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim rhetoric, which is apparently right in line with the leader's vision for his party and its future.
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. Freedom of religion is a term that is more and more frequently used and misused. At the same time, there's a freedom that's even more basic for any person on this planet. Freedom of conscience, freedom of thought. And on this front, the organization Humanist International has been compiling an annual global Freedom of Thought report for the past 10 years. The 2021 edition was released this week, and I am happy that it brings American Humanist Association Policy and Social Justice Director Rachel Deitch to State of Belief Radio. Rachel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Please, let's start with you describing for us the objectives of this annual report, if you would.
So the objective of the report is simple. It's to track the treatment and rights of humanists and non-religious people in every single country around the globe.
And how many countries are included in the 2021 edition of the Freedom of Thought report?
That's a great question. So this year will be the first year that the report only updates a third of the countries. Humanist International, who are the publishers and authors of the report, felt that it was important to ensure that they can dive deeply into every single country. So this year, there'll be new updates for a third of the countries.
Talk about, if you would, the ways freedom of thought is measured and ranked in this report?
Yeah, so there are more than 70 boundary conditions, which are statements that may or may not apply to every country in the report. And what they do is they fall into four categories: constitution and government, education and children's rights, family, community, society, religious courts and tribunals — that's all looped in as the third category — and freedom of expression and advocacy of humanist values. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And every country is basically measured against these boundary conditions, be it, is there a law prohibiting free speech or blasphemy? Is there prohibitions against humanist or non-religious people from holding political office? Items like that.
Are you able to pull out a top five and bottom five countries and talk about some of what earns them those positions?
That's a great question. When you think about top five countries, there's so many criteria that go into what we think of when we think of freedom of thought around the world, that to limit that to five countries, mm-hmm. I'm not sure we could really do that justice. What the report found was that there's 144 countries around the world that restrict the rights of humanists, or in which humanists are discriminated against. There's 39 countries with state religion. There's state legislation derived from religious laws in 35 countries. I could go on and on. And so I think to restrict it to just five would lose the scope in the picture of what the report really does.
As you look at this year's report, what were the biggest surprises for you in this year's findings?
Yeah, so I think the two most surprising things to me came out of two new boundary conditions that were added to the report this year. One was on the use of conscientious objection clauses that result in the denial of lawful services to women and LGBTI folks. And the second new boundary condition is that there's a dominant influence of religion in public life that undermines the right to equality and non-discrimination in 24 countries. And when you look at those together, I think what the report does a really good job of is understanding how religious freedom of religious minorities, including the non-religious, also intersect with the rights of women with sexual health and reproductive health rights, along with LGBTI people. I think, those 24 countries, which you can find on the report's website, are all available to take a look at. I think the countries, of course, that still have death sentences for blasphemy, you know, we want to see that number going down, and unfortunately mm-hmm. we're not. And so I think more needs to be done in that area as well. And that's, you know, something that you hope we move the needle on, but is always dismaying to see that, unfortunately, those bad actors still have those egregious laws in place.
There's no question that freedom of thought is essential for the protection of freedom of religion. And yet, again and again, we see secular persons, as well as followers of minority religions, being marginalized and even persecuted. Why do you think societies, including our own, seem so blind to the rights of less popular belief systems?
That is a great question. I think when we talk about those concerns, what it comes down to, in my view, is fear of change, fear of difference, fear of someone saying the way you see the world isn't the way I see the world. When we're talking about religion and belief, we're talking about core values and foundational understandings of the way the world works. And so on an interpersonal level, myself as a humanist and as an atheist, my existence, my statement that I don't believe that there's a God, it, to some people, is blasphemy, is a threat to the way they see the world and the way they live their lives. And when you take then individuals and you create systems and you create infrastructure, you create systems, you know, that translates into governance, that translates into laws, it translates into weaponizing one's belief, unfortunately, sometimes. And I think that's where you get, you know, the restrictive laws that this report tracks.
Rachel, I'm curious as to what we need to know about the partnership on this report and beyond between American Humanists and Humanist International.
Yeah, of course. So the American Humanist Association, my organization, is a member organization of Humanist International, whereas the American Humanist Association represents the interests of humanists and non-believers in the United States. Humanist International does that on a global level. And so while Humanist International is the author and the publisher of this report, the American Humanist Association was honored to be asked to host this year's global launch event in the United States. This year's event is virtual, so it's not, you know, in Washington, D.C. per se, but we were very honored to take on that role.
Mm-hmm. Across the 10 years that this has been going on, what are some of the trends that have emerged that you know that you're going to deal with?
I think we're seeing greater pressures. And, you know, going back to that boundary conditions of these are two new boundary conditions, and the items they focus on aren't particularly new, but we're capturing them in new ways. So when we think of conscientious objection, and it's something we're seeing in the United States, especially of people saying, I'm not going to treat you as a medical practitioner, for example, I'm not going to treat your medical needs because of my religious beliefs. I think that's a really scary trend that we see. Mm-hmm. Additionally, the influence of religion in public life. I think what's really important when we're talking about the rights of non-believers is that it's a concealable identity. Well, you don't look at me and know that I'm a humanist. Why mm-hmm. would you? But in a lot of places around the world, the ability to conceal that identity in some ways is a matter of life and death. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of being respected and or ostracized by your neighbors and your family. And so what we're seeing, what this report tracks in some ways is practices, is stigma, which is really hard to capture. But when we're looking at the metrics of who feels able or protected to share their thoughts and their values out loud, I think we're seeing that tracking in some scary directions.
Hmm. What are the very real costs to citizens when freedom of thought is curtailed? And do people tend to take that seriously enough, do you think?
I think in the United States, we certainly take it for granted. I think in my international work, the very, very real costs of this are people's lives at stake. It's people like Mubarak Bala, who's been incarcerated since April 2020. He is the president of the Nigerian Humanist Association, and he was arrested and very recently charged with insulting religion. And so he is in custody still without access to basic human rights because of his beliefs, because of his identity. That is a very real human cost. His safety and life is at risk. His family's safety is at risk. Other humanists in Nigeria, of course, their rights are restricted. And then you also have, you know, I don't want to just limit the conversation to humanists. You have Ahmadi Muslims being killed in Pakistan for their beliefs. Mm-hmm. That is a very real face on the limitations that folks have around the world when it comes to their religious rights.
Mm. Pluralism and diversity have been on the rise in many parts of the world. Has that helped increase freedom of thought in those places, or has there sometimes actually been a backlash leading to greater dominance by a threatened majority?
You know, I don't have evidence to speak to the latter there, mm-hmm. but when we're talking about positive developments, you know, Ireland and Canada more recently repealed their blasphemy laws. And that is pressure. It's It's pluralism, it's greater respect for diversity of thought. And that matters when we're talking about moving the needle in these countries where those laws are still applied. We're able to point to positive changes. We're able to point to the value of religious diversity, diversity of thought, diversity of expression. And that, I think, matters in a really positive way. So I would always push for more pluralism, more diversity of thought. The more voices we bring to a conversation, I think the stronger that conversation will be.
In all of these areas, what are you seeing about what's happening to women in this?
Yeah, so the same way that LGBTQ people and other religious minorities are discriminated against or persecuted through the justification required through religious beliefs, the same applies to women. You see women accused of blasphemy laws because they're willing to stand up and, let's say, start their own business. You see women's rights restricted through religious means. The access to abortion comes to mind throughout the world, as well as other sexual reproductive health medical needs. And you see religious limitations from all sides. You see health restrictions, you see employment restrictions, you see marriage restrictions and freedom of education restrictions. Gulai Ismail is one of the guest speakers on our event for the launch. She's a Pashtun women's rights activist, and she has experienced firsthand the connection between women's rights to civic engagement, women's rights to education, as well as tied to blasphemy laws and blasphemy accusations and her right to be a humanist and an atheist. And in her mind, all of those combined into one kind of field of activism.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, what have I not asked you about this report? Because you know it better than I do. And I want to get what is really important to our listeners. And you will know that if I haven't asked it. So tell us what else we need to know from you.
I think what you need to know from me is that evidence is best understood firsthand. So I'd encourage everyone to go look at the report. It's at humanist.international is how you can access it for yourself. It's an iterative report. It is virtual. It is interactive. And so if you're interested in a particular country or a particular boundary condition or way of rating the report, go find that out for yourselves. It's exhaustive. You could spend days looking at this report, and I wouldn't attempt to give it to you in a three-piece soundbite. So please take a look at the report for yourselves.
I'm curious if once you pick up this year's publication and you look at it, do you say in relation to what we've known over the 9 years before, we're not making any progress, or we are making progress and I'm optimistic?
I think we're making progress just by virtue of what the report is and what it means. When you think about policy and how we kind of create the world we need to have for all people to experience their inherent human dignity, knowing where the problems are is the first step. Knowing what countries are doing something well is the first step. And so the report, just how, you know, how broad it is in scope and yet how detailed it is, that to me is a piece of power. That is a piece of being able to walk into a congressman's office and say, this matters. Here's the data you need to really understand so that the policy that you create is helpful to these people, is helpful to these communities. You know, what I've seen in my short time working with the American Humanist Association is that the data matters and you have to follow it and you have to be able to collect good data. And that's hard to do when you're talking about stigmatized minority groups. It's really hard to collect that information. And I think we've gotten better at it over the years. I think I've seen other organizations, do it better as well. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom has started paying more attention to the rights of humanists. The State Department's paying attention to how our rights are infringed globally. And I think the more reporting we can do, the better. And so I'm going to say that things are looking up because we're seeing more data, and that in itself is helpful.
Well, before we go, how can our listeners follow and support the work of the American Humanist Association and Humanist International?
Love that question. If you're in the United States, you should absolutely become a member of the American Humanist Association. You can visit our website at AmericanHumanist.org. Or if you just want to stay in the loop with what we're doing, you can check us out on Twitter, American Humanist, without the A in can. So American Humanist is our Twitter handle, and please follow us on Twitter. With Humanist International, if you're joining or listening from outside the U.S., definitely take a look at their website and see if you can find a humanist group in your area.
Rachel Deitch is Policy and Social Justice Director at the American Humanist Association, which partnered with Humanist International on the release of the 2021 Freedom of Thought Report. We'll link to that important report from stateofbelief.com. Rachel, I really want to thank you for taking time to be with us today, for enlightening us. You're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was.